Good afternoon. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. This morning on Talk of Iowa, we learned about the pollutants in our waterways and the impact of Iowa's agriculture land on our water supply. And this hour, we continue our environmental series called Ripple Effects by looking into something far less visible, the air we breathe. Iowa is not known for having bad air quality, especially compared to places that have smog, like Beijing or Los Angeles, but we still know so little about what is in our air and how it may affect us. To talk about what Iowa's doing well, what we should be concerned about, I'd like to introduce our guests joining us this hour. Here in the Iowa City studio with me, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Professor of Occupational and Environmental Health at the University of Iowa. Welcome, Patrick.
No, thank you for having me.
And joining us from Des Moines, Sean Fitzsimmons. He's a unit leader of ambient air monitoring at the Department of Natural Resources in Iowa. Hi, Sean.
Hello, Emily.
Good morning. So, Sean, can you shed light on the basics of what's in our air, besides the main gases we know, like nitrogen and oxygen?
Well, what I do mostly is look at the national ambient air quality standards and pollutants for which we have national standards, and those are based on gases or other substances that are in the air in enough sufficient amounts that they affect a large number of people. So let me just run through those.
And this is the EPA regulating these,
That's right, at the national level. Okay. For example, in Iowa, we have 37 monitoring sites in the state. 10 of them measure SO2, sulfur dioxide. And sulfur dioxide is commonly produced from burning coal. Coal has sulfur in it, and it also comes from other processes like steep tanks when you're fermenting corn or something like that, but mostly coal combustion. Lead is a toxic metal that's often found at scrap or metal manufacturing facilities. It's also in paint. PM2.5 is another of the – we have one lead monitor in Iowa. PM2.5 is particulate matter that's 2.5 microns or less in diameter.
And what is that for the average person, 2.5 microns in diameter?
Well, it could be almost anything. It's just the size of a solid or liquid droplet, and it's commonly thought of as smoke, if you look in the ambient air away from sources, you can say that it's roughly a third carbon, a third nitrate, and a third sulfate, with nitrate only persisting in the winter. But if you get close to a source where you've got like metal fume or something like that, it contains components of whatever the source is. Mm-hmm. So then we also have PM10. We filter samplers. We have 18 of those. So PM10 is a little bit larger than PM2.5, 10 microns instead of 2.5. So it gets those particles that are a little bit larger, more like dust, like road dust or something like that, whereas you can think of PM2.5 as more like smoke. So we have 18 of those. We have 15 ozone monitors We measure ozone at 15 monitoring sites out of the 37. So ozone is created when NOx interacts with VOCs. It can be either NOx.
And NOx being?
I'm sorry, nitrogen oxides.
Okay.
When you have a combustion source, some of the nitrogen in the air gets burned up and oxidized into NOx. So anything that's a combustion source will produce NOx, cars or power plants or anything like that. And if you have VOCs and sunlight, that's the recipe for ozone. It's commonly found at highest levels downwind of cities during the summertime. Mm-hmm. Carbon monoxide, everybody's familiar with that one. It's a product of incomplete combustion, and it comes from cars and just any combustion that isn't using up all the carbon, starved combustion.
So of what you're monitoring, what are you most concerned about? Are there certain pollutants that you're taking a look at more than others?
Well, the things that we care most about, for one thing, ozone and PM2.5 are a big deal because they tend to be elevated over large areas. So if we look at, say, the 2011 to 2013 data, the last that's a three-year period that has the latest data in it. The ozone standard is 75 parts per billion. And in Iowa, we measured a median of 65 and a high of 69 at Pisgah, which is pretty good. So so for that pollutant, which tends to be elevated over large areas, we have only 69 part per billion compared to the 75 part per billion standard. But EPA is proposing a rule that's expected to be out on December 14th, and the range that they're looking at is 60 to 70 parts per billion. So if they went with 60, most of the state would be out of attainment. If they went with 65, we'd be half and half. So it looks good now, but the next change, and that's where we're at with ozone. For PM2.5, the standard is 35 micrograms per cubic meter. The median in our network is 24, and the high is at Garfield School in Muscatine, 28. So we struggled to meet that one in Muscatine. So the monitor at Garfield School oscillated in and out of attainment. It was out of attainment in 2007 to 2009 and 2008 to 2010, and then in the intermediate three-year periods.
Mm-hmm. And attainment meaning it's not meeting those standards.
Right.
The national standards.
The monitored value, they call it the design value, is not meeting that 35 microgram per cubic meter standard. So in July of 2011, EPA told us we were failing to maintain the SIP, maintain the ambient standards, and asked us to do a SIP call where they told us to change our rules in the Muscatine area to maintain the NAAQS for PM2.5. And then in Valentine's Day of this year, we submitted the SIP. And so additional controls will be required under a consent order from beginning in 2013 to the end of 2016. And the thing is, you know, we're in attainment now in Muscatine, but in the past we oscillated in and out of attainment, so we've got to add additional controls.
And we'll be talking about Muscatine coming up in the second half. We have someone joining us who lived in Muscatine. But for right now, I want to concentrate on the idea of smell. Like I said, we're going to be looking at a lot of examples throughout the state this hour, but I want to know what smell can and can't tell us about air quality. Cedar Rapids is commonly known as the city of five smells. River-to-River producer Claire Roth hit the streets of Cedar Rapids to ask people how much they know about the air quality of the city they live in. Here's what she found.
Smells like Cedar Rapids. Smells like river. Smells like garbage. It smells like Mount Trashmore. It smells awful. Yuck.
Sometimes like garbage. sometimes like Cap'n Crunch, which is a good day. Not like normal air.
Like just a really old, dirty puddle. You know, with like chalk in it.
Being from Manhattan on the East Coast, I think it smells pretty good so far.
It smells like home.
It smells like home.
As soon as I come from out of town, I drive into Cedar Rapids, I'm like, I'm home.
It depends on the day. Some days it smells like oats, and other days it smells like cinnamon crunch, and other days it smells like disgusting chicken nuggets. I'm sure those smells aren't good, because they don't smell natural, and I feel like it's not fresh air.
I know it affects my health. When you breathe in toxins, your body takes them in and has to deal with them and makes you sick, makes you age. It's overall unhealthy for you.
They call it the city of five seasons, and I think it's the city of five smells. Yuck, yak, yuck, yuck, and yuck.
So, Patrick, you know, one of the last voices we heard, the woman seemed pretty sure that she was breathing unhealthy air. Mm-hmm. Do we know if that's the case? I mean, I know there's various smells in Cedar Rapids, so each one probably affects you differently, but how much do we know?
On a compound-by-compound basis, not a whole lot, to be honest. It's very difficult to put together what would be an epidemiological-type study, which is how we've learned so much about the pollutants that Sean was talking about. These are the big six, the criteria pollutants. And so the EPA had to start from someplace. One of the most famous studies is called the Six Cities Studies. It's Pittsburgh, Seattle, Houston, L.A. This is where they had enough people breathing the same kinds of pollutants for long enough that they could start isolating out the issues and the health effects associated with that particular pollutant in the air relative to everything else that makes us sick for whatever reason, in addition to smokers, asthmatics who have other other issues going on at the same time. So that's what it takes to say, yep, that thing out there at this concentration is causing this kind of effect, and we know it well enough that we can say we better regulate this down to this level. When you start talking about odors, now we're in the realm of a multitude of different types of compounds out there that are, yes, they came from some source. There is some factories, some stacks, some whatever agricultural area that generated these. I keep calling them compounds because, again, they can be very complex mixtures of both gases and individual molecules that are coming from that source and hitting our nose, and our nose is going, ugh, you know, something just hit me. Mm-hmm. Now, does that mean that that's something that's going to cause a health effect? Well, again, science doesn't have an answer for all of this. If you can isolate it out, and unfortunately it would take very sophisticated types of instruments, these things called gas chromatographs can isolate out different types of compounds and say, oh, you've got some sort of a residue from the alcohol refinery process coming from this particular plant, and you've got some compounds coming from the grain or whatever else is coming out of another plant, and those, you know, in excess could cause problems. Very difficult question, unfortunately, but people need to understand that odor isn't necessarily associated with the pollutants that are regulated, especially. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to River from Iowa Public Radio. Today we're talking about Iowa's air quality, how we impact the world's air quality as a state, how the world's air quality impacts Iowa, and how the air you breathe in every day could affect your health. We were just talking about smell. Cedar Rapids, known as the City of Five Smells. What does the air in your community smell like? You're welcome to join our conversation with your questions, comments, stories. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Again, that number to call is 866-780-9100. And my guests with me this hour, Patrick O'Shaughnessy of the University of Iowa and Sean Fitzsimmons of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. And, you know, we can't talk about smell in Iowa and not talk about our livestock practices. According to the Iowa Environmental Council and the National Atmospheric Deposition Program, Iowa has some of the highest concentrations of ammonia in the lower atmosphere in the United States. And ammonia is emitted mostly by livestock production and nitrogen fertilizer use. You know, ammonia is not one of the six pollutants regulated by the EPA, so how much do we know about it?
Ammonia is something that there have been clinical studies, for example, where there's either been some sort of a animal subject, as they're called, and or human subjects that for which they've gotten responses out of well enough to know that there are limits by which we need to regulate ammonia. Most of that is related to the occupational world, where folks are in some sort of a plant where they're producing ammonia and have to make sure that the workers are down to some level. In the atmosphere, it's a little trickier because we have more dilution going on. However, there's also people that are more at risk, like the elderly, pregnant women, children, and that sort of thing. So that's why outdoor air limits are always much lower than the limits they have for workers. Yes, there's a lot of ammonia coming out of agricultural buildings. There's also hydrogen sulfide, for example. That's that rotten egg smell you may get once in a while. There's been a few marginal studies, I would say, that have looked at those kinds of emissions and suggest that there may even be some behavioral changes in folks in terms of not just what you would think of as the typical pulmonary effects and or cardio effects that you get out of the big six, the criteria pollutants, but also mood changes and other issues that they found were kind of interesting out of those kinds of studies, and some of that just may be the constant aggravation that these folks are subjected to when they live very close proximity to some of these large facilities, for example.
Yeah, you don't like smelling manure from the lagoon constantly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, how close do you have to be to one of these concentrated animal feeding operations to be worried about health effects? The specific, you know, lung irritation, mm-hmm. chronic lung disease, that sort of thing.
I think I'd punt to Sean on that one. There are setback distances that the DNR have established.
Sean?
Well, we had a little bit of experience. We took odor measurements from 2003 to 2005 and hydrogen sulfide pneumonia measurements from 2002 to 2007. And so we did find that near certain lagoons that we'd get plenty of hydrogen sulfide. We were using a concentration threshold of 30 parts per billion that they had in California. But what happened was we were monitoring in the wrong place. The legislature nullified our ambient standards and told us we needed to monitor near separated locations. And so what a separated location is, it's kind of like a house near a lagoon or maybe a church or something like that. So we moved our monitors over to those places, and we didn't see too much there. But so I guess I'd say you got to be pretty close from what we saw to have levels of hydrogen sulfide over 30 parts per billion. We didn't have a very large study set, maybe 16 monitors, I guess, over the history of the study. One thing that happened after we finished was that there's a national air emissions monitoring study that took place, and all the CAFOs got together and they funded a study that Iowa State took part in. Al Heber from Purdue was kind of heading it up, and the goal of that thing was to be able to estimate emissions from CAFOs, like if you knew how many animals and some other operational parameters, you could estimate how much ammonia came off of it and things like that. And they're still working on that data. I just saw some of that the other day. But that's some of our local efforts were subsumed and certainly done very well by the national folks working in this National Air Emission Study.
Mm-hmm. I could jump in on this. Sean was nice enough to give us some of his data on that study where he had these 16 monitors around, and we analyzed it for this particular reason, trying to figure out how far back do you go before you really have a background signal left that there's no way you can tell it comes from that particular animal facility versus that one. Mm-hmm. And it does seem like that the concentrations, and this is gases now, this is not odor, and this is where the two things really are difficult to come to grips with, where odor seems to be able to travel, and your nose is extremely sensitive to these particular scatoles, they're called, and indoles. These are compounds that are extremely like a skunk that can go for miles downwind. But the gases, like hydrogen sulfide, tend to drop off fairly quickly and within about a mile, and certainly within 2 miles of a very large confinement building, there's not much left. Yeah.
I want to talk about regulation of these concentrated animal feeding operations. I know that each state, along with the EPA, has the authority to require that these organizations measure and control their emissions. But you have some criticism from advocacy groups like the Environmental Integrity Project. They say state regulators have only exercised this authority in a few cases. They cite this because of industry lobbyists undermine enforcement efforts. You know, Sean, how would you respond to that? What is CAFO enforcement in Iowa like?
Well, we've been out of the air monitoring business for a while.
In terms of monitoring the air around these areas for, let's say, workers.
I think kind of the focus these days, I don't know about the OSHA cut sort of inside the fence line thing, but this National Air Emission Study, the idea was that if they did some careful measurements, then they could figure out whether or not they were subject to Title V, for example, the federal air quality permitting program, or subject to release elements of the federal law. And so that was kind of the applicability part of it was is kind of where the focus is these days, to try to figure out if they emit enough of things so that they'd be subject to different regulatory programs.
We usually think of dirty air as being in cities, but that may not always be the case. You know, we mentioned particles like dust and smoke. So how do Iowa's large agriculture operations affect the air in rural areas? Patrick?
Yeah, that's a tough question. There certainly are sources. You know, there's no way you can argue that there are gases, for example, emitted out of these facilities. There's anaerobic and aerobic bacteria within the lagoons. They are doing their job of trying to break down so there are emissions of the gases.
Cornfield, for example, though, like agriculture.
Sure. And within a certain radius around one, and when we do the analysis, we're looking at the meteorological conditions that are going on in Iowa and what kind of conditions may exacerbate or cause a buildup of concentrations around these facilities. And sometimes if they're in a valley, that, of course, causes problems. If there's a inversion of air where there's basically a trapping of the air below, it's that can cause, and this happens, say, and sometimes even in the wintertime, where you get concentrations building up. That's probably the worst case scenario for local residences. How far, again, it travels beyond that is debatable. As far as a particulate matter emitters, I'm thinking of, say, a swine confinement operation. There isn't as much of a particulate problem coming out of them, just because, again, there's just not that much there to cause issues for residences outside of the CAFO. For the workers, that's a different story. Yeah.
We're talking air quality this hour on River to River, continuing our environmental series, Ripple Effects. With me here, staying for the next half of the hour, Patrick O'Shaughnessy. He's a researcher at the University of Iowa. And Sean Fitzsimmons. He's with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. If you want to join our conversation, do you have questions about the air quality in your area? What are you smelling? What are you noticing? You're welcome to give us a call at 866-780-9100, or you can email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Coming up, we're going to be visiting Muscatine, Ames, Council Bluffs, taking a look at the air quality in those areas, as well as Linn County, to talk about their idle-free policy and how they're curbing car vehicle gas emissions. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. The Iowa Public Radio talk shows are in the middle of our summer series on the environment. It's called Ripple Effects, and this hour we're looking into the air we breathe, Iowa's impact on the ozone that keeps us safe. Iowa's known for having pretty good air, but there are pockets of concern across the state. In the first part of the show, we talked about the impact of concentrated animal feeding operations and our agricultural practices. And in this half, we're going to travel around to different cities across the state. Some are taking steps to better their air quality, and some have a ways to go. And joining me for the rest of the hour, continuing from the first half to talk about Iowa's air, Patrick O'Shaughnessy. He's a professor of occupational and environmental health at the University of Iowa. Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
And Sean Fitzsimmons is joining us from Des Moines. He's a unit leader of ambient air monitoring at the Department of Natural Resources. Hi, Sean.
Hi.
And I want to get to a listener question. This is Pete from Bellevue. Hi, Pete.
Yes, how you doing? Great Hi. To have you guys on today.
Sure. What's your question?
Always wondering, I heard your newscast about a grant being turned down for solar energy, and it makes me wonder, in terms of what these people do in terms of monitoring air quality, is there typically a difficulty in getting the resources, the funding for complicated tools of technology to do this monitoring in multiple sites? And is it also a matter of what can citizens do out here to encourage, you know, our elected officials to take our environment more seriously?
Who wants to take that?
I could start, and Sean certainly can pipe in here, knowing the complexities of setting up these monitoring systems. They certainly are expensive. They involve fairly sophisticated equipment that, and there's a lot of quality assurance that needs to be applied to these to make sure that the data that you obtain is something that the EPA would listen to. But I mean, I think it's a great idea in terms of citizen support for monitors out there. That and they're certainly getting to be more and more sophisticated at less and less price in terms of some things that are available. But to monitor, for example, PM means capturing these little particles on a filter. So air is sucked through a filter. You have to weigh it before and after. So that means you have to have a very sophisticated balance to make sure you have an accurate measurement. The gas monitors are on the order of $20,000 to $30,000 each. And so that's probably the downside to trying to expand the monitoring system, if I heard your question right.
And Sean, do you have anything to add to Pete's question?
Well, there are some citizen science groups that do good work, and you know, it's like you say, it's probably $90,000 for a monitor like the ones we run. It takes about $40,000 a year to get somebody to run it. But there are things like the Bucket Brigade that you know, they'll take a sample of air and send it into a lab and see what they find. There's some new stuff that EPA is looking at, some new sensors. There's something called the Air Quality Egg. That people are developing. There's something called the Shinsei PM sensor that, you know, you can buy for $20 or $200. And anyway, EPA is taking a look at these things on a national level because they'd like to see more measurements out there. And they're willing to, you know, have a little less quality and trade it off for quality, kind of the idea of like a Fitbit type sensor, you know, that you could walk around with and have some idea of what, say, the ozone was in your community. EPA is looking at those, funding different people for sensor testing or groups, and it's a very active area of interest. If you've got a kid that likes to play with an Arduino or a Raspberry Pi, they've got a sensor for you that you can put on there and start measuring some air quality. And, you know, having bad hardware, it's not a good thing. You know, you waste a kid's time if you give them a sensor that won't work. You know, give them a telescope instead. But these days, there's effort being put into improving the quality of those sensors so a bright kid can do some science.
Mm-hmm. Jim in Fairfield has a more specific question. He says, the largest grain elevator in the state is planned to be built near Fairfield by Heartland Co-op. How does a grain elevator affect air quality? Sean, do we know this? Do we know the effect of grain elevators?
I did a little bit of testing at grain elevators, and so the displacement air will often have particles in it, and so there's also it seems like there's grain dryers that sometimes will blow chaff around when they dry the grain. It's been a while since I tested these things. Often the air inlets are way up in the air, and they're difficult things to test. But grain elevators are certainly something that have been on the Air Quality Bureau's agenda for a while now in terms of, you know, how do you regulate them and what are their effects.
Mm-hmm. Now, moving on to, you know, we mentioned those specific pockets in the state. A few weeks ago, we aired a show on the new EPA standards that plan to reduce carbon emissions by 30%. And I encourage you, if you're interested in air quality, you can find the podcast of that show on our website, iowapublicradio.org. Click on River to River. And I bring this up because on that show, we received many calls from Muscatine residents who are very concerned about the air quality in their town. They mentioned suffering from asthma, lung irritation, breathing concerns. So here to talk about Muscatine and its air is a former resident and former executive director of Clean Air Muscatine, Jessica Brackett. Welcome to River to River.
Thanks, Emily. Glad to be here.
So how long did you live in Muscatine, and what was your experience like?
I lived in Muscatine in 2012 and 2013, but my brother and his family have been living there for over 12 years, so I've been familiar with Muscatine for quite a while. Muscatine is really a sad story. There is a part of Muscatine called South End, which if you live down there, your home, your car, the whole neighborhood will get coated with grime on a daily basis. Now, I lived up out of Southend, and most days were pretty good. But every time I would go down to Southend and spend more than a couple hours there, I would have to be sure that the rest of my day was clear because I knew that I was going to feel sick the rest of the day. I was going to be nauseous, I was going to have headaches, and it would stick around for at least the rest of the day, if not 2 or 3 days. The organization that I worked for, Clean Air Muscatine, we did quite a bit of door-to-door work in Southend. So we went and talked to residents. What we found were nearly every child that we spoke with in Southend had asthma and had breathing problems, and then just a plethora of other diseases with nearly every household that we stopped at.
Wow. So do you know what's causing these problems? I mean, I know there's a lot of manufacturing that goes on at Muscatine.
Sure. Well, yes, there are numerous manufacturers, but really the outlier is Grain Processing Corporation. And one of the things we haven't talked about yet is acetaldehyde, which is a byproduct of corn processing. And according to the Center for Public Integrity, GPC is the highest emitter of acetaldehyde in the country. And the long-term effects of even minimal exposure are the same effects as long-term alcoholism. So,
because it's a corn-based product. Is it like an alcohol? Is it for an alcohol product?
Well, it's a byproduct of processing is what I can tell you. Okay. And it's in the same family as formaldehyde.
Mm-hmm. And recently, Grain Processing Corporation received the highest state penalty for pollution violations. I believe it was $1.5 million. What happened there, Jessica?
Well, it was, on one hand, it could be considered a win. This was the state's lawsuit against GPC, and Clean Air Muscatine was an intervener in the lawsuit. Now, the fact that Clean Air Muscatine could be an intervener was a big win. But unfortunately, $1.5 million, even though it may be the biggest environmental fine in Iowa's history, is just a drop in the bucket to GPC. They are a billion-dollar corporation. According to the Chamber of Commerce, GPC provides over $1 million a day in taxes to the state. So GPC is just laughing their way to the bank on this one. $1.5 million is nothing to them.
Hmm. Sean, do you see this as an example? I mean, although, you know, maybe not such a penalty for the company, you know, it is a step forward. Do you see this as an example of when regulation works, when monitoring works?
Monitoring hasn't worked yet, I guess. Right now, the National Air Quality Standard for SO2 is 75. And based on the last 3 years, they're recording 217 part per billion at Muscatine or in Musser Park there, 217 compared to 75. So that's really high. And in terms of exceedances of standards, you know, when a kid with asthma would need to cut back on their activities, in 2013 at our Garfield School monitoring site, we had, 28 days where a kid that had asthma would have trouble. At Greenwood Cemetery, we had 5, and at Musser Park, 34. So that's a lot of time out of the year when you've got to be careful, know when the wind's blowing, and cut back on your activities, or you'll have you're at higher risk for an asthma attack. Now, most of the air quality that we see, at least according to the EPA scale, is in the code orange level. So those folks that have breathing problems and asthma, those are going to be the ones that are affected. At the red levels, the unhealthy levels, that means anybody, you or I, would be affected. But the way the Clean Air Act works, it protects groups of sensitive individuals. And most of the ones that we see in Muscatine for SO2, the exceedances we see are in that unhealthy for sensitive groups category, the kids and asthmatics and so on. Mm-hmm. And then, we've had some PM2.5 problems in Muscatine as well. But I guess just to finish on this SO2 issue, the consent decree that was signed on March 14th is huge. GPC is switching from coal to gas, reducing their SO2 emissions by 12,000 tons per year. So that's going to happen next year let's see, by July 2015. So this time next year, they're not going to be burning coal anymore. They're going to be burning gas. And that's going to have a huge impact on the SO2 in the area and the number of exceedances and levels relative to the NAC. So I'd just like to commend CLAM for working with those the folks at GPC to get this done. Because if you relied on the federal process, here's how that goes. EPA designated that place in non-attainment in October of 2013. The SIP, that where we put in permit limits that would get the place back into attainment, that's not due until April 6th of 2015, so next year. And attainment isn't required until 10/4/18. So there's such a long period of time where folks in that community are dealing with that level of air pollution that it's, it's just really commendable what CLAM has done and what GPC has agreed to do. Mm-hmm. We have three SO2 monitors in Muscatine, two that we've just put on lately. And I guess another thing that we're doing, the DNR is doing in Muscatine, is we're measuring formaldehyde and acetaldehyde. So in Musser Park, we've got a monitoring site there, and it's something that we do in our major cities, and we do well. And so there'll be some data for the folks in Muscatine to have a look at and, see what the acetaldehyde levels are like. That's what this consent decree that that CLAM was a part of was really huge. And then I think it's also a great step for GPC to kind of embrace the community and the health of the community and agree to do some of these things. They're not taking the full time that the Clean Air Act would allow. They're getting it done early. And like Jessica said, they have lots of resources they could fight, but they're, mm-hmm. Working with the folks in Muscatine.
And Jessica, does your brother plan on staying in Muscatine for the long term?
Well, it was questionable for a while, but it looks like he's going to stay there.
All right. Well, Jessica, thank you so much for joining us to talk about Muscatine air quality. Jessica Brackett, she's the former executive director of Clean Air Muscatine. Thanks again.
Thank you.
So we're running out of time this hour, but before we get to that, I'd like to talk briefly about Council Bluffs and Ames. Council Bluffs repeatedly received air quality violations due to a factory that produced lead pipes, the Griffin Pipe Products Company, which is now closed. So, we had this lead pollution coming from Council Bluffs. Now the factory is no longer running. But, Patrick, how much do we know about how long these effects last from factory pollution?
In terms of, well, it depends on the type of compound. Is that what you're thinking of?
Mm-hmm. For example, lead.
Yeah, lead is a problem, certainly. That's a type of, you can think about what the body does, and we have professors that know a lot more than I do about the toxicology and what happens when you get a toxin of some sort, a compound in your system, and how your body breaks that down and how it may turn into different types of compounds as it gets broken down and what those do to your system. Does it affect the liver, et cetera? Something lead, obviously, is not something you're going to break down in your body very well. It's going to get stored up in tissue and migrate it to places, especially things that are in the nervous system that's going to affect. So it's a bad situation to have exceedances of lead, and it's extremely rare in this country, actually. Thankfully, since the Clean Air Act in 1970, when I was young enough to be driving around in cars that were fueled with leaded gasoline, of course, and it was pervasive across the country. So we're doing a much better job there. But, there's actually a reduction in IQ in children that's been shown by scientists because of overexposure to lead. So it's a real problem. Other things, SO2, NO2 that we've been talking about are obviously going to be more transitory unless you're constantly hit by it, day after day after day. Then you're going to develop perhaps a chronic conditions, bronchitis, et cetera, versus more just that kind of irritated feeling you get out of your lung. So it depends, again, on the pollutant type.
I'd like to bring Amy into the conversation at this point. Amy Drejos is the senior air quality scientist of idle-free Linn County. We're talking about vehicle emissions here. They're a major source of air pollutant. And this idle-free rule throughout the county prohibits unnecessary idling. Amy, welcome to River to River.
Well, good afternoon, Emily. Thanks for having me.
So what was the need in Linn County? How did this come about?
Well, just to clarify, in Linn County, idling is not illegal. There are other parts of the country where it is, but we decided just to take a proactive response and look for ways that we could reduce unnecessary air pollution. And just simply educating the residents in Lane County about turning their vehicle off when they are not moving. Idling is, the description of idling is when you are running your vehicle, but you're not moving. So we're trying to encourage Lane County residents to reduce pollution simply by turning their vehicle off if they're going to be waiting somewhere more than 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm. So is the end goal here, I know you're specifically looking at schools, Idle Freeland County partners with schools. Is the concern asthma in young children?
Well, that is one of the concerns. We do know that children are more vulnerable to increased concentrations of air pollution, and vehicle exhaust leads to poor air quality, especially in concentrated amounts. And when you think of the drop-off and the pickup lines at school before and after school, you have several vehicles lined up and buses. So that can lead to increased air pollution in those concentrated areas. Children are smaller. They breathe twice as fast as adults. So we were looking for ways that we could help improve the air quality for students, as well as the bus drivers and the staff that are in that area. And so we worked with several school districts to educate parents, educate their bus drivers. Some school districts have adopted policies to limit the amount of idling that their school buses do. And we've had a lot of positive feedback.
Have you received any pushback on this? I think, you know, a lot of people think, oh, you know, it's better to, you know, leave my car running than keep turning it on and off. Is
that absolutely
true?
Yeah. Well, actually, the response from the school districts that we've had that have worked on an idle-free program at their school, we've had really positive feedback. I mean, the parents and caregivers and bus drivers, they want to do the right thing. They're looking for ways to improve air quality as well. So we've had a lot of really positive feedback. But you're right, there are several myths out there about vehicle idling. One is that idling is good for your engine, which actually can damage your vehicle, causes more wear and tear on the vehicle. Another myth is that restarting your car uses more fuel than when you let it idle. That's untrue. Engines don't work as efficiently when they're idling. And so if you're idling more than 10 seconds, your car is wasting fuel, which means you're, one, you're polluting the air unnecessarily, and you're also wasting your own money.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I think about, you know, definitely schools, any parent that's been to drop off their kid at school, you know, everyone's waiting in line. But also in Iowa, I think a big problem is when you have semi-trucks and delivery trucks stopping and idling at rest stops and things like that. You know, I want to bring Patrick and Sean back into the conversation. I mean, do you think it would be pretty hard to do something at a larger level in the state of Iowa? Almost, you know, going as far to say, could we make the whole state of Iowa idle-free? I know that's a tough question.
One situation I've heard of course, is when buses are coming up to schools and you've got a diesel just spewing out of those things while everybody's waiting. So there's maybe isolated scenarios like that, and at places where buses are congregating, that there could be better ways of regulating emissions at that point. I'm not sure how they could do it, but I was just in San Francisco recently, and you know they've got all those old trams you can see in the posters and stuff. But their entire system out there is electric, you know, in terms of buses, for example, that would make a huge impact on any town, any city, to reduce those emissions.
And you know, while we're talking about regulation, things like being idle free, penalties for polluters, you know, I want to, you know, almost end the hour with a quick comment from Dr. Maureen McHugh. She's an Iowa City physician and coordinator for the state chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. I'm sorry. We're running out of time. I'm going to give a quick question to all three of our guests, Patrick, Sean, and Amy. You know, what could we be doing as local communities, as people, to be aware and help promote better air quality in our state? Patrick, let's start off with you.
Be active and be cognizant of it, that we take this for granted and that we think, everything's okay and or we're faced with situations where we have an obvious pollution situation and we just have to be active. I think there's some great groups out there that you can join. So that's what I would suggest.
Sean, very briefly.
Yeah, clams a great example of what people can do to improve the air quality in the area. If you got a big factory next to you, know what they're producing. Look them up, Google them, take a few measurements if you can, and get involved. Talk to those people that live in your community that are the environmental folks at those places and make some things happen.
All right. Thank you so much to my guests, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Sean Fitzsimmons, and Amy Drejas. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Claire Roth. It's a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury.